bilateral treaty of Honduras and the United States. He is a man being killed in violation of the law.
Let's kind of review those agreements, those treaties, and exactly what they contain.
Well, the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs guarantees that every citizen of a foreign country that's detained for any kind of serious crime has a right to talk to his government, and the government, there's a duty of the United States government to notify that government. And you can think about it. It makes such common sense. The U.S. supported it. More than 170 nations have signed it. And it was that on basis of that treaty that the Medellin case went to the United States Supreme Court and was recently decided. The Supreme Court of the United States, following the International Court of Justice, understands that the International Court of Justice in The Hague has said that the United States is in violation of this treaty and has urged the United States to not to execute any of these foreign nationals, but particularly the Mexican nationals. And what's happened as a result of it is that the Supreme Court of the U.S., when it went up under the objection of the state of Texas, not following what President Bush had asked, Supreme Court of the United States said that procedurally the President of the United States had been defective in issuing the request to the state courts to follow international law. Now, Chi, we thought, was different in the sense that he was protected by a bilateral treaty. No one really knew that a bilateral self-executing treaty would be so important until the case of Medellin versus Texas, just decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it looked like Chi was in a pretty good case. He had a very good argument. Mr. Moon and the Texas Defender Service that worked on him, as well as the Honduran government, presented the case eloquently, and it simply was not adequately considered by the Supreme Court of the United States.
We're talking with Terrence O'Rourke, who teaches law at St. Thomas. My name's Otis McClay. I'm sitting in for Ray Hill on this execution watch because we fired Ray. No, actually, he's doing something else. I don't know, maybe levity's out of place because, once again, the state of Texas is exercising its prerogative as a state to kill somebody.
Well, you know, I say it as a lawyer, I say it is that there's no international sheriff. The reason the state of Texas is killing Mr. Chi is because they think they can get away with it. There's not really an issue the state of Texas is violating international law today, right now. Well, they're killing him unlawfully.
No, but now, how does that Supreme Court case, the one, what was it in, Jim, in 78? The case that said that the states did not have to conform to the international treaty unless Congress itself actually passed a law saying that the states had to conform to this international treaty. And I should say what the treaty says essentially is if a national is arrested in another country, then they have a right to see their consul.
Well, see, I differ with Terry. I understand from the Geneva Convention that we don't have the states don't have the obligation to notify the consulate. They have the obligation to notify the defendant that he has the right to see his consulate. I don't know of anything.
Is that a state law? Or?
No. That's what the treaty said. Okay. The Vienna Treaty said it didn't say that the arresting official had to notify the consulate. They said they had to advise the defendant of his right to notify the consulate. Didn't say they had to notify the consulate. Now maybe the Honduran treaty is different. I don't know, but there's nothing in any treaty I've ever seen that says a law enforcement officer has to notify the consulate. They're supposed to notify the defendant. He has that right. It's his option to try to get the consulate. Now I don't know. Maybe the Honduran treaty is different. Terry can talk about that.
Yeah. Well. Okay.
Well, and the International Court of Justice has found that when you read the treaty, that is the consular convention treaty, a duty of the United States to adequately inform the foreign government in an appropriate way, in a timely manner, which didn't occur here in virtually any of these cases involving the Mexicans or.
Are you saying that's
Mr.
a ruling of the International Court of
Justice?
Hey.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, one of the questions is. Is it a right? I mean, does Mr. Chi have a right? Do these citizens have rights, or do the governments have rights? And there's still an issue of ambiguity that these are agreements that is still called international law and not global law. And so essentially that governments contend that they have rights and duties under these treaties, and then their citizens have rights and duties. And that's we're in that area where it's being defined right now. But what is clear in the case of Mr. Chi is that from the very moment of his arrest in California on a fugitive warrant that said citizen of Honduras, that he was not notified of his capacity to notify his government. And it's also clear that his government was not notified until very late, until he was set to go to trial for capital murder. And why it's so important is that Texas has two systems, as everybody knows, on the trial. One of them is, are you guilty of the crime? Chi is clearly guilty of the crime. But the question is, should he be executed? And that's why the notice provision to the government is so important, so especially a citizen from a third world country who has limited means can get witnesses from his own country to appear in his own behalf to essentially plead for his life. And that simply didn't happen to Chi and most of the 51 Mexicans who are, you know, in line to be killed.
Billy has something. Billy Sinclair?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mr. O'Rourke a question. The Medellin case sort of became ripe for review after we had the Avena decision come down, and President Bush got into it, and it went before the United States Supreme Court. Had the issue, the Honduran-related issue concerning the treaty, been presented all along in the Chi case, and had it went to the United States Supreme Court before Medellin, or even before the Avena decision, what prospect do you think he would have had of the Supreme Court recognizing the treaty obligations?
Well, I want to be sadly candid. I believe that if you know, Honduras is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere, next to Haiti and Nicaragua. The per capita income in Honduras is the lowest in the Western Hemisphere. We're not talking about Mexico with 100 million people that's an oil-rich nation. So, and the relationship of Honduras to the United States is such that when you kick Uncle Sam in the shins, you've got to pay a lot of money, and there's a big political price. So one of the answers would have been that if you had a lot of money and had a lot of time and brought the Chi case in a different way, at a different time, that he might be alive this evening. I mean, that is the sad reality. His case has been well argued by Mr. Moon and the others in the Texas Defender Service, but the answer is that there weren't adequate resources on his case. Also is, no one really knew that the so-called self-executing treaty with Honduras would be that important until the case of Medellin versus Texas was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court.
You know, it seems like there are a couple of issues. One of them is our willingness to participate with the rest of the world in things that we should do. I certainly know that when Americans get arrested in Turkey for having a joint in their bag, the first thing they want to do is see the American consul. And the consulate, it seems this is kind of suggesting to the rest of the world, well, you don't have to worry about that. You know, Americans will take their chances just the way anybody else here will.
Let me tell you the problem I have with this Chi case, and I wish Member Terry can address this. It's never been determined, number one, at least in our courts, that a treaty confers individual rights you can bring up in court. That's not ever been determined. Now, in some dicta in a case that came out some years ago, they assumed that a defendant did have some personal rights because of a treaty. But then they said the exclusionary rule was not applicable. It wasn't the correct remedy. Now, let me explain what I mean by the exclusionary rule. And our jurisprudence is kind of unique. Back in 1917, our courts decided that if the lawmaker or the lawman, the police officers, break the law, and if they break the law and gather evidence as a result of breaking the law, they would exclude that evidence from courts, called the exclusionary rule. Texas has a statutory exclusionary rule. In this particular case, when I read the opinions, assuming, for example, that this was a treaty violation, assuming that she had individual rights, assuming there was a motion to suppress, what evidence did they gain as a result of violating the treaty that should have been suppressed? If Mr. Rourke would address that.
That is, in the case itself, the officer who was doing the booking in Los Angeles, where Chi was arrested, his testimony was important because they got in a confession by Chi where he had either no Miranda warning or consular warning, and there was a motion to suppress that testimony, and it was denied in the trial court. And I believe that Chi never got a fair hearing on the issue of the Vienna Convention or the Honduran government's position under its bilateral treaty, so that in terms of being prejudiced, he was completely prejudiced by the failure to have adequate notice.
But you're saying he didn't get, he wasn't advised of a Miranda when he was arrested?
That's correct.
But we need to clarify that. Let me explain how this works.
Okay.
In order for Miranda to be applicable, two things must happen. You must be in custody, and it must be in response to custodial interrogation. If I'm arrested and I just pop off before I'm Mirandized and admit doing something wrong, that's going to be admissible because it's not in response to interrogation. What happened when she was arrested, what occurred, after the killing in Fort Worth, he and his girlfriend took off and were gone for like 43 days, and he apparently beat her up. She turned him in for assault. He's arrested in California. And when he's being booked in, now he's not being questioned, he's being booked in, he made a spontaneous statement. Now, our Supreme Court has said over and over again that even questions asked at booking are not interrogation questions where Miranda applies. He's being booked in, he's not being questioned by the police officer in Los Angeles. He volunteers it. He makes a spontaneous utterance. That would be admissible absent Miranda. It'd be admissible absent any type of violation the issue when a statement is made is, number one, whether it's voluntarily made. Now, remember, Miranda and any type of violation has to take two things. You've got to be in custody and you've got to be questioned. Now, if you just pop off and say something without being questioned, that's going to be admissible whether you've had a Miranda warning or not. And that's why I think they granted the motion, would not grant the motion to suppress. It was considered spontaneous utterance.
What he said admissible. But what he said in the confession was that he was at the store, but he didn't shoot anybody.
That you are completely correct, and that has been the state's argument, that they had an independent state law ground and that you didn't have to go to the federal question about the treaty law violations. And the argument that I would make is, or that was not made at the time but has been made afterwards, is that on the arrest warrant itself, on the fugitive warrant on Chi on which he was arrested, said citizen of Honduras, and that he should have been notified, especially when it's obviously a capital crime, that the duty goes right then, that it's not a custodial issue of a spontaneous statement. And then there's the other problem, is that because it was all in Spanish and it was by this booking officer, you know, one of the questions is, was there adequate cross-examination on that issue? But the treaty issue, it appears that his treaty rights were violated, certainly from the perspective of Honduras, that the treaty was not respected either in the spirit or the letter, and that the state of Texas... And I was in the meetings with the governor's office when this occurred last time, when we were up there to argue for mercy, asking for clemency, and it's clear what they said is that, you know, we make no argument. We did violate Mr. Chi's rights under the Vienna Convention. There's not an issue on that.
The issue is not so much, there's no mercy in Texas. If you don't know that, you don't belong to live here. You know, you need to move somewhere else. But the issue is he did not invoke his right. Whether he was aware of it or not doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he did not know of the consequences of not asking to talk with somebody from the consulate.
Well, again, here's my problem I have with this case. Number one, assuming there was a treaty violation, it would not have kicked out the confession had it been, the statement had it been a spontaneous utterance. Number two, another problem this case presents is this was not brought up on direct appeal. The issue of the motion suppressed was never discussed on direct appeal. The only thing discussed on direct appeal from this case was the constitutionality of the statute. You've got to bring this up on direct appeal to preserve error for writ purposes, because your direct appeal's got to cover everything the future writs cover. This is called procedural default. When the lawyers wrote the brief on direct appeal, they never brought up the issue of the motion to suppress being improperly denied. That was a dead issue. It was never brought up. Number two, let's assume, for example, they have reversed the case. They said it was error to admit it. Your other problem you have is what we call the harmless error rule. And the harmless error rule is real simple. Even though there's an error, you got to demonstrate how you were harmed by it. In this particular case, the problem that I can see from a defense viewpoint is, number one, Chi goes to a store where he worked as a tailor. People knew him there. Prior to going to the store, he went in around 6 o'clock in the afternoon, talked to a lady at the store to make sure there were no policemen around. Came back just before closing time. Three people were in the store. Three people knew who he was. He robbed three people. There were three people there. He shot two of them. what the inference would be from the prosecution to a point that he's going to kill all the witnesses. I'm sure that's what they probably argued at the trial level.
Let's suspend that for just a second, Jim. Gloria, hi.
Hi, Otis.
What's the question? What's going on?
Well, there's about 15 members of Roberto's family standing here waiting for the witnesses to come out. They haven't come out yet.
Okay.
So we won't know for sure that it's happened until we see them. So we're standing here waiting.
All right. Let's.
Roberto's mom is on the phone talking to somebody in Honduras.
Okay. Well, can we just hang in there and we'll finish this discussion that Jim was saying. Jim, I interrupted you.
Oh, no problem at all. Because, see, the problem you would have in this case is that you have two witnesses, at least three witnesses, who identified him. They had Chi's voice on a 911 call. And there's no question, as you say, he committed the murder. Then what would the statement, how was he harmed by the statement that he spontaneously made to the Los Angeles Police Department? All he did was admit a robbery and claim he didn't do the killing. It wasn't your classic confession like in Medellin. The big problem is, how do you get around the harmless error rule? Because they're going to say, looky, you got eyeball witnesses. You got his voice on the telephone. There's no question he did the killing. Well, and so how do you get around the harmless error rule?
I'm going to ask a dumb question here. This is a dumb question from somebody out which you know, you or Terrence or whoever. But it seems that the harmless error rule is just another way of saying procedure is unimportant.
Well, let me try to answer. When you're on the winning side, you always say the errors are harmless on the other side.
Yeah.
In the case of Chi, I don't think there's any way that he could have prevailed on the merits in the sense that he obviously killed the people or killed the guy in a terrible crime. But the issue of whether or not he should die in Texas today has to do with the punishment phase, and there's a lot of evidence that comes in all of these cases in the punishment phase that takes time to prepare. And in the Chi case, the records of the Honduran government and the case records show that they simply just didn't begin that phase. I guarantee you, if he had money or if he had had, you know, good private counsel at the time, you do all kinds of things to say my client ought not be killed. He committed a terrible crime. I mean, we watched this so recently in Galveston with Dick DeGuerin that it's almost shocking to us. But Chi never had that opportunity. He never could. And it takes time, especially when you're from a third world country like Honduras is, to be able to get your family, the clergy people, your previous employers, all those kinds of records that you try to put onto a jury to say, don't kill me. That didn't happen in the Chi case.
But his attorney was not a bad attorney.
No, I'm not arguing that. I'm not arguing he's a bad attorney, and I'm saying, you know, that's not my position.
I would like to just make one point, and I think Terry brought it out well. And that is that if he had spoken to someone that he trusted, because most foreign nationals, and Univision encounters this problem all the time, they have a very strong lack of understanding of American law and American process and American procedures. So if he'd had someone he trusted other than, let's say, an American attorney to come and speak to him shortly after he was arrested, he would not have engaged in behavior in the jail like supposedly being part of a satanic religion. They would have told him, look here, you got to be on your P's and Q's now. You got to watch your behavior. They would have given him advice that you're in a fight for your life. So anything you do in this jail, anything you do in the jail system, whether in California and in Tarrant County, is going to come back to impact you. So that's the value of getting that advice early on, because it goes directly to the punishment stage.
Jim.
Let me add a problem that I hate
Let me say, well, this is Execution Watch. Okay. Gloria is on the line. We're waiting for word from Huntsville. And we're talking about Alberto Chi, who is a Honduran national, and some of the issues about the fact how we deal with citizens of other countries. I'm sorry, Jim. Jim Skelton.
So as I understand it from what Terry said, that really the admissibility of the statement from Los Angeles didn't have any particular impact that would have convicted him anyway at guilt or innocence. The issue was punishment. Here's the problem with that. And I haven't seen anything to change my mind on this. I just got through with a series of writs on a lawyer being ineffective. And what the new trend is now, especially in the Supreme Court, is to be critical of not what lawyers do, but what lawyers don't do in preparation for trial. Now, let me give you an example. We had a case here a number of years ago in which a lady was accused of killing her baby. And the baby is around, I think, around 9 months old. And the child had had medical problems in the very beginning. A real good lawyer friend of mine pled her guilty because they didn't have enough money to go through the medical evidence. Our Court of Criminal Appeals reversed it because on a writ, they showed what the lawyer should have done. Now, when you prepare those writs, what you've got to do in those writs is make a proffer of evidence. You can't just go in and say, this could have been done. You got to have live, living people that sign affidavits. In this particular case involving the baby, they got doctors who examined the autopsy report. They made a proffer of that testimony, what witnesses would have said. I'm just finished. In fact, I worked on a writ this evening involving a shooting case in which we went out and interviewed every witness who was present during the shooting, got affidavits from them, said had the lawyer colleagues, people, they would have testified this way. And everything I've seen on the writs in this particular case, I would be curious to know what sort of mitigating evidence that they could present that wasn't presented and who would have said it. Because you can't just get up and say we would have done these marvelous things. You got to have actual living bodies signing affidavits willing to say, had I been called, I would have testified. I've seen nothing in any writs that have been prepared by any defense lawyers that made a proffer of proof they would have shown. And you could develop this without a problem involving a treaty violation. You could have developed this on a Strickland problem. Let me explain what Strickland means. Strickland is the standard Supreme Court's used to measure the effectiveness of a law. And there's two things you've got to show. Number one, the lawyer was negligent. That's usually very easy to show because no trial is ever error-proof. The big problem is what we call the but-for requirement. But for the error, the result would have been different. So to show that result is different, you've got to present testimony in a writ showing what should have been done in a case that would likely not get the death penalty. And people have done a lot of talking. I have seen nothing by way of writs, nothing by the way of affidavits that they would have presented. If you'd have a lawyer in the world, what would you have presented that was not presented? I'm curious about that.
Jim made one excellent point, but his analysis is confined strictly to the law. I go back to the point that had Che been talked to early on by someone he trusted, then he would not have engaged in behavior that contributed to the capital punishment verdict that was returned. Now, whether or not his lawyer not telling him to engage in that kind of behavior would satisfy the Strickland prejudice test, I doubt that it would. But what it does show in a very practical way that if a client or someone who's arrested, and particularly a foreign national, and we're not talking about someone like Medellin who's lived in America all his life. We're talking about a foreign national who had just come to this country and knows absolutely nothing about the judicial process and the penal process here in America. Had he spoke to someone earlier, at least there would have been some evidence that the state could not have used his writings on a prison, on a jail wall, his supposedly belonging to a satanic religion. Those kind of things would not have been.
The state of Texas has murdered Heriberto Che.
Let's talk
right here in Huntsville.
Right, Gloria, you're on.
Heriberto's cousins and representatives of the Honduran consulate and the Honduran embassy are walking out of the death house. His cousin just turned to the family. About 15 of them are standing down here. And he's waving to all of us. Before he went in, Heriberto's brothers told him in Spanish, tell him that we're here and we love him. So it's over.
Gloria, how does that help?
Help what?
How does that help him?
Help who?
Help the man they just murdered.
Doesn't help anybody except the stupid politicians in Texas that can't figure out how to deal with crime, who want to use the death penalty to get reelected. Other than that, you know, they're murdering poor people who didn't have a dream team. That's what happens day after day, week after week here in Huntsville. So right now there is about 15 people over there. The mother is surrounded by a couple of sons and her sister.
You want to go over? Do you want to get over there? Do you see if do they have anything they want to say?
His brothers. Hernan.
We just have a situation where state of Texas just killed the child.
This is Hernan in English.
This is one crime, racist. We are poor people. We cannot defend who they know that. They are making business with penal capital, making a lot of money with that. This is a business, you know?
I think that pretty well
they are not
says it.
The international trade, you know? They don't respect nothing. They don't care the other country, the poor country. Texas is racist.
Okay.
And we are happy. You know why we are happy? Because my brother, he is with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Hernan.
Thank you, you. We need to follow helping these people.
Well, you know.
Oh. Okay.
This show's kind of a weird, strange show. The idea that we do a show every time there's an execution.
Yeah.
And I've always thought, you know, the original idea of executions was you would do them in public where everybody would see it, you know, and then we'd, you know, have the...
He saw that horrible crime. I was not ready for that. Okay, sir.
All right, Otis.
Thanks, Gloria.
Okay.
What else?
Another sad day here in Huntsville.
Yeah, and two more next week, it seems.
One of them is has given up his appeals. He's one of the... so-called Texas 7.
Okay.
You know, Iliberto's younger brother, the baby brother, is 17. His name is German. He told me, he's only been here 2 years, but he told me that they're going to take Iliberto's back to Honduras. He said that his grandmother was thinking that something would happen. She said, but in July when she got sick, she told the family she was letting go because she didn't want to be alive when they executed her grandson.
Mm.
So they buried the grandmother in July. So now they'll be burying Iliberto. They're bringing his property out, one onion bag with papers in it. That's what's left of him.
Okay, Gloria.
All right, thank you.
Doing your job, and of course I should point out that Gloria does not get paid to do this. Gloria has been fighting the death penalty in Texas for, well, as long as I've been here.
Since she was born.
Yeah, since she was born.
And she's a good warrior. Yeah. Okay. Now, do you remember back in the old days you
were speaking? Wait a second. Hang on a second, Dan. Gloria, we'll let you go.
Yeah?
We'll catch you later.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you
do
next week.
Do you remember
week.
In England, when the pickpockets were watching the walking the people watching, they were still picking pockets.
Yeah.
So what kind of a deterrent is the death penalty? Come on.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, we had this idea, this original thing about the deterrent and, you know, those public executions and everything. And, of course, what we've done here, as Ray has pointed out, and I think, you know, everybody in this room would probably agree, we've turned it into this secret ritual, you know, where we pretend that we're being nice. I mean, we go from the electric chair to the gas chamber to these other things and... you know, it's like somehow it doesn't make sense. And what we get out of it is the state will never give up its assertion that it has the right of life and death. And, in fact, the only real thing that it can do is kill you. It can't create life. All it can do is take it away. And the state's not going to give that up.
I think Gloria's comment about them bringing out his personal belongings in a bag and giving to the family. I spent a number of decades in prison,
right.
And I saw a number of people die, a number of people kill. And the sadness about any death in prison is you're reduced to, and any time a person dies, whether he's killed in a knife fight or he dies of natural causes, is the prison officials come in and collect his stuff and put in a bag, and every life in prison is reduced
to that bag.
Those belongings in that bag, and there's nothing more poignant. And And it has a sober impact on all the other inmates that see it carried out because they know that they could the same thing could happen to them, and your life is reduced to just a few items in a bag. And that's what, to me, what Gloria said there underscores everything about the barbarity and what we engaged in tonight. The state of Texas engaged in this afternoon.
Let me just say one other thing. I'm Terrence O'Rourke again, and it is so clear that if Mr. Chi had money, if he were not an undocumented person working here, and we've had hundreds of thousands of Hondurans as well as literally hundreds of thousands of Mexicans that are so essential to the economy of the United States working in similar conditions, it is so clear that if he'd had money and if he'd had the kind of dream team, you know, who knows what could have been offered. But how many people, when it comes to the question on the jury about should you kill me or not, can't produce better evidence than what was available here. Simply, sure, a lot could have been done. Were the lawyers who did do the best they could? Yeah, I'm not. There's no argument that I have about negligence on anybody's behalf, and especially in the last few months, weeks, years, the time in trying to save Mr. Chi, a lot of people did a lot of very good work. It is that the economic reality is that we're killing poor people. And if they had money, they wouldn't be killed. And it reminds me, because I grew up here in Houston, about the time when we used to do things to African-American people just because the color of their skin, and the feeling I have is very much the same, and that is one of shame for my state and my country.
I have to agree. And I think, you know, in all the times that I've done, the years that I've done shows here and, you know, been involved here, I've come down to the idea that these are actually human issues, and they have to do with human behavior, because there seems to be a deep need on the part of people who are have power in society to demonstrate their power. And, you know, who was the only rich person on death row was Duff Smith?
Duff Smith.
Was the only
rich because he killed his family.
Yeah, I mean, it was like so amazing. I mean, this is like, that was the only one. Everybody else on death row has been poor. And we know that there's this correlation between how much money you got and whether you get the death penalty.
Well, let me explain. I'm not real big on just bitching about problems. We ought to have some solutions. And one of the things, let me give you an example. I can give this best by example. A number of years ago, a lady at the Halley Theater was killed by a gentleman.
Correct.
Your name is Miss Sith. And the lawyer that handled that case was Ron Mock. And I did the appeal on that. And what I argued is that he was rendered ineffective because the state refused to provide finances and investigative expenses that the state had. For example, the state in getting ready for this case spent, I forgot how many thousands of dollars. They went to New York because he was Mel Meyer in New York. They interviewed people in New York. They interviewed people in New Mexico, and they interviewed people in California. Yet Ron was limited to $500 in expenses on his investigative expenses. There's no way he could have fought that. Well, what I tried to argue that he was rendered ineffective because they should have the same amount of money available to the defense that they had for the state. And in fact, this case I mentioned recently where the lady entered a plea of guilt and they reversed it, Judge Cochran wrote the opinion. What Cochran basically said, that courts have the obligation, if somebody, although they can afford a lawyer, if they're too indigent to get dropped medical, get expert expertise, courts should provide that money. Now, in this particular case, if he was poor and indigent, one of the things that kind of bothers me, why didn't the lawyers bring this issue up on appeal, saying the lawyers were rendered ineffective because they didn't have the money to spend on his defense? We have overlooked that, and I think that's one thing that we should look at in death penalty jurisprudence, is start saying that we have to have the same amount of money the state has got, and don't have it, we're going to be rendered ineffective. But yet, that's not been perfected by lawyers at the trial level. Sitting around and complaining does very little good unless we have a solution.
Just get back to this in a second. On the line from San Antonio, we have Luis Vera, who is a national legal advisor for LULAC, which is the League of United Latin American Citizens. I know LULAC, but not the thing. Senor Vera, you're there.
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
What is your take on what just happened, the death of Alberto Chi?
Well, you know, our position at LULAC has always been that all immigrants deserve the due process of the law. Not only the law that we have here in the United States, but that we must honor all the treaties that have been made with other countries, because we expect the same of them. When we have American citizens in Mexico or Honduras or whatever country they come from who violate a law in that country, we expect nothing but both their law and international law to apply, and those are the arguments that are used by our State Department and by those who seek their freedom. But yet we don't respect the same of people from other countries when they're alleged to violate a law here. So, and we're disappointed that the court did not review the arguments that were, you know, made by his attorneys.
What? Tell me about this. Are you Native American, or are you North American, or you've lived in other countries?
I'm sorry. Would you repeat that?
I'm just wondering if you've lived in other countries.
I've spent a lot of time in Mexico.
Okay. What?
I am first generation Mexican American.
Do you think there's something about North America that feels it should be above the law or different, or? I mean, our courts have gone so far as to say that the treaties don't really apply. I mean, at least that's my impression. Jim could correct me, I'm sure.
That's what they're saying. I mean, they just said that with Medellin. And as I said, you know, there's a big difference between, you know, we have this separation of powers and separation of the way things are done in this country under our Constitution. But yet, you know, they're supposed to all work together. And if the Congress of the United States and the President make a treaty with another country, then the same way they pass laws that those judges are to enforce or to, not to, I'm sorry, not to enforce, but to interpret, then the same, in my opinion, when the Congress and the President make a treaty, that is the law. And that is the law that the justices are supposed to look at when they decide.
And yet we seem to not bother to do that. And I'm just wondering if it's kind of a national pride or, you know, what is it, some kind of North American hubris?
I wish I had the answer. As you know, history goes in cycles. And, you know, during the time period when some of these treaties or all these treaties have been made, the feeling at that time would be that, you know, international law or the treaty would be followed. That's why they were done. And unfortunately, in the area that we are now, or this time in history, the justices that we have, at least 5 out of 9, don't believe they apply. As you know, these have been all 5-4 decisions.
You know, a lot of what they don't believe applies is not just to foreign nationals. Seems to be a lot of us here. Billy Sinclair has a question.
Mr. Vera, I'll preface this that I don't think it's so much a North American problem. Of the 1,100 people executed in the United States since 1976, over 900 of them were from this one region of this country in the South. And of that 900 put to death, almost 800 of those come out of four states, which is Texas, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Missouri. Those are the four leading states that have executed the most people. And in prefacing that, so I just think it's the death penalty itself in this country is a very localized, regional punishment. It's not a national punishment and I don't think most of the states in the United States embrace the Supreme Court reasoning in Medellin, like Texas does, and a few other states does it, that the International Court of Justice has no business imposing its decisions on the states. Jim Skelton pointed out yesterday that Arkansas has already agreed to recognize an ICJ decision. Now, having said all that, my question to you is, what do you think the long term impact of not only Medellin and the Chi executions, but any other executions that's carried out against foreign nationals, what do you think is going to, not the immediate impact, but what's going to be the long-term international impact for these kind of executions being carried out and Americans are being arrested in other countries?
Were you asking that question
yes,
police?
Of you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking someone else. I apologize.
Right.
Well, I think the long-arm implications are exactly where the position that the United States is in now. That is that our relationship with other countries has continued to deteriorate, and it's going to continue to deteriorate. And you know, the history, again, of the United States was the United States was always seen as a not only as a world power, but as a place of justice, as a place of freedom. And that just continually is deteriorating. The world does not see America as what history portrays it. And, I mean, you hear the pundits talk about that, all that on TV of how much hatred there is for Americans, even when Americans travel. I mean, again, I spend a lot of time in Mexico, and those questions are posed to me all the time. And, it's a sad situation. So I think, the long-term, prognosis for the United States and its relationship to the world is poor. Every time we execute a foreign national, no matter what country that person is from, appeals come from all over the world for something to happen other than the execution. Religious leaders throughout the world take that position also, not only the politicians, but again, our policy at this time in history is nothing else matters except for the execution. So that is not very, very good for us.
What is how is LULAC dealing with this? I mean, who do you talk to? Where do you push?
Well, I think that we need to keep pushing among the legislatures and whoever the new president is going to be. You know, the next president of the United States is probably going to pick probably the minimum two new Supreme Court justices. And that'll be a major step forward. Again, depending on their ideology in this area of the law, we'll decide how many of these executions continue or whether or not we have another halt on them to review the treaties and I mean everything, the due process that everyone deserves, including all the executions that happen here in the United States. So that's what we do. We will continue to advocate not only among the legislators of Congress to pass laws that ensure that, but to be, you know, to be able to make the legislation necessary to get the Supreme Court to do what it needs to do. They can do it. It's just going to take, it's going to take a strong will to do it. And of course, whoever the new president is going to be, when it comes to choosing that new nominee for Supreme Court, of course, the president will have a say-so, but also will the Senate. So if the Democrats keep control of the Senate, which we hope they do, then it'll be their responsibility to see who the ultimate nominee is, no matter who the president names. So that's what we can, not only LULAC, but all organizations and all citizens as a whole who
okay.
care
let
about
me, let, let me touch on something that you mentioned. You mentioned the religious leaders. What manner of clout, Lewis, do the religious, what clout do they have? If religious leaders in this country, any country, had any clout, including the Pope and all them good folks, Billy Graham, you know, with this administration in?
No.
With this administration, don't you think that something would have happened if the religious leaders had any clout whatsoever? Thank you.
They obviously have clout religious areas where they all get killed. kills people.
Did you hear, Luis?
I heard both of that.
You're just saying, okay.
Why the religious leaders don't have as much influence on this administration as they should?
Yeah, I think that was pretty much what Dan said.
Well, they hypocrites or, what are we talking about?
This is the way I tell people.
I mean, George Bush claims to be born again.
Here's what saddens me. You know, I see every day people who fight the abortion issue. You know, the right to life, and that's fine.
Well, you're talking about the right to life for this man's
fighting
life.
For the right to life are the first ones standing in line for the execution. And it's the same thing with those same politicians. You know, you have certain policy holders who will, you know, claim that they're right to life, but right to life where? And so you're right. They have absolutely no I guess the word is hypocritical. There's no other word.
Mr. Baird. You're going to save people's, you're going to save the baby so you can put him to death when he's 25.
Well, that's what they do.
Yeah. And
same
and
thing of, there's, you know, we spend all our money in prisons instead of schools.
There's
so
a deeper issue of true insanity here. And we're so deeply in the insanity that we don't even see it anymore.
It's Einstein's definition of insanity.
Well, trying to do the same thing over and get different results. It's not even that.
Mr. Baird, to get away from
Billy
the,
had something.
This is Billy Sinclair. To get away from the religious aspect for a moment, do you think that the Supreme Court decision in Medellin and the two executions being carried out this week and the others that will certainly be carried out involving foreign nationals, do you think this is going to make foreign embassies, foreign countries instruct their embassies to get more involved very early on if a foreign national is arrested in this country, particularly for a capital offense? Do you think it's going to make them get more involved by bringing in legal assistance, investigators, and that sort of thing to make sure that their rights are fully protected shortly after they're arrested?
Good question.
This is Luis. You know, it would take, of course, extra resources and for them to do that, because they are not notified of when a foreign national is arrested. Now, you know, some jurisdictions do. I'm very familiar with some jurisdictions that immediately will notify the local counselor, you know, with a list the next morning of any national that was arrested. But unfortunately, in high-profile cases, which these death penalty cases are, they're the last to be notified. You know, the investigators, the officers do everything they can to get confessions out of these people before they even are allowed to contact an attorney. That's what happens, you know, all the time. So could the foreign countries take this position? Yes. Of course, they also know that it's going to cost resources to do it by having to have, you know, personnel there at police stations or whatever, wherever they're brought to, the jails, and make, you know, an instantaneous list. But they're going to do it, I doubt it. I wish they would, especially in the jurisdictions that have no respect for international law, Texas being one of them. But, you know, it just takes extra resources that I don't think they're going to do. I wish they would.
Not good. Okay. Luis Vera, is that an accent on the A? No. Luis Vera of LULAC. Thank you for spending this time with us. Do you have anything you want to leave us with?
Well, thank you very much for your time, and I really appreciate what y'all do. I think what y'all do in informing the citizens through your radio station of the truth of what's going on, so they don't just read somebody spit out of the newspaper, is very important. So thank you very much.
Thanks. This is Execution Watch. I'm not Ray Hill. I'm Otis McClay, sitting in for Ray on this particular event. I think we have two more coming up next week. Dan gave me the list. We do have a webpage now, executionwatch.org, which has the recordings of these shows and all that other stuff. And I think it looks like, what's the 17th? No, is this right? Oh, that's the date of birth. We're down to, oh, yeah, this is it. On the 14th, on the 12th, is Leon Dorsey. And I think that's a Tuesday, I'm not sure. And then we have two next week, Leon Dorsey and Michael Rodriguez. I don't know the stories. Jim knows. We will have those stories for you. I got a question for Billy Sinclair, who spent years in prison, and for Jim Skelton, who is an attorney here in Texas, one of the people who's spent his whole life trying to get the justice system to work. Can I say that? What is going on? I mean, I see as we get older, you know, as the nation matures, I'm seeing us move away from all the things that the revolution was fought for to the same old stuff. The, you know, you were talking about the causal, which I'd never realized, this causal relationship issue, where even though procedure's not followed, that you'd have to prove that it would have made a difference in the verdict.
rather than just a prima facie case that you got to follow the procedures.
See, and I tend to blame everything on Republicans and Baptist preachers is what I tend to blame everything on.
Yeah, no,
on.
And
see, the problem
there.
Is Baptist.
But Rehnquist went through that whole, all the time Rehnquist was, of course, we know how he got started in Phoenix. His whole thing was to accelerate the process and shorten the appeals. That he even thought that was an important thing and was one of the first people, I think, to start working at getting rid of habeas corpus.
Well, that's not quite fair. Part of it is because we abuse the habeas corpus right, and I've really been critical of that, because part of the reasons we have a lot of these laws that limit the right to habeas corpus is that a lot of writers have abused it by filing writ after writ after writ, knowing, for example, knowing that it would never work. Let me give you an example. And this is one reason lawyers are discouraged about death penalty.
We've got about 3 minutes. Okay.
Okay. I helped Will Gray years ago. He got into bind on a writ case. And I spent free of time about 2 weeks locked up in an apartment doing a writ for him. I did it in his behalf. Gave him the writ and he mailed it off. To get another stay of execution, they accused me of not notifying the defendant when in fact it was Will Gray's client, not my client all along. And the problem is that a lot of these writ folks that believe are against the death penalty will tell any lie on the face of the earth to get a 30-day delay or something delay, and our courts reflect a lot of that. Part of it's our own fault.
But isn't that the way the system works anyway?
Well, a part
you
of
you don't have to be a writ writer to lie on a writ.
Well,
do you?
I'm just simply saying that they've a part of it's because we as defense lawyers have abused the system. The other part of it's been politicized because nobody's running for office being liberal on crime. Everybody who runs for office is to lock them up, and we politicize the system. This is what happens because. In fact, the war on drugs became as a political toy, by the way, the Nixon administration to have an issue to argue about. And so what's happened when you politicize a system and have judges elected, in fact, we had a guy named Ted Poe, we had some more of them, that ran on campaigns about killing more people.
Right.
In fact, one of them said that he was a prosecutor in the candy cane killing, was real proud of that fact. And so part of it's been twofold. Number one, it's been politicized. Everybody runs on a law and order campaign. And I think we share part of the blame, too, because there's a lot of things that we've done to abuse the system. And I think it's reflected part of that. So I think we share part of the blame. And really the biggest irony of all of this, the best place to really get killed is where there's religious people. I mean, they love God by executing folks.
No one ever points out that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was intended to limit the penalty.
Exactly.
Not create the penalty. So the guy sitting in the car who gets turned in by the guy who pulled the trigger, that's not eye for an eye, tooth
good
for a
point
tooth.
Of it. Good
anyway,
point.
Billy, do you have anything? We got about... Well, 10 seconds. Say something really good in 10 seconds.
A French philosopher said the world will never know peace until the last priest is strangled with the interest of the last general.
Very interesting. And this is somebody who's had plenty of experience. I want to thank Elizabeth Stein for producing this. I want to thank Dan Grunstrom for being here. Dan, I don't even know your name. And Ray for being behind this. And Jim Skelton for being part of this. And I'm Otis McClay. And thank you all. And I got to see the second hand right here. This is KPFT Houston HD2.